Oh, Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is such a threat. We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Joshua. Te washtelo taya wachianke chante washte na pechu zapiello le chante etaha awogalake le unkipiki he washtelo. Greetings and good day and welcome, my relatives. I shake your hands with a good heart. This is a voice from Earth. It's good for all of us to be here. You are listening to First Voices Radio and Teokas and Ghost Horse, sending you greetings and strength from the highlands of the Esopus, or what Americans and Dutch call the Catskill Mountains. Regardless, it is the highlands of the Esopus, the lands of the Munsee-speaking Lenape. This is an all-native hosted, all-native produced First Voices Radio, and Liz Hill is the producer of First Voices Radio. How do these words affect your mind? Hospicing modernity. We'll find out in the next 45 minutes or so what that means to Indigenous peoples and perspective that you may not have heard in your lifetime, or maybe you think you have and that you know. The perspective of Native Indigenous to this land and to the Western Hemisphere. Hospicing modernity, driven by expansion, colonialism, and resource extraction, and propelled by neoliberalism and rabid consumption, our world is profoundly out of balance. We take more than we give. We inoculate ourselves in positive regard while continuing to make harmful choices. We wreak irreparable havoc on the ecosystems, habitats, and beings with whom we share the planet with. But instead of drowning in hopelessness, how can we learn to face our reality with humility and accountability? Vanessa Machado de Oliveira Andreotti is a professor at the University of British Columbia. She holds a Canadian research chair in race inequalities and global change. She began her career as a teacher in Brazil, and she was generous enough to give us an interview here on First Voices Radio, where she breaks down archetypes of cognitive dissonance, the do-gooder who does good enough, then retreats to business as usual, the incognito capitalist who, at first glance, may seem like a radical change maker, and asks us to dig deeper and exist differently. She explains how our habits, behaviors, and belief systems hold us back, and why it's time to now gradually disinvest, and we can reimagine how we learn, unlearn, and respond to crisis. And I talked recently with Vanessa Machado de Oliveira Andreotti, right here on First Voices Radio. Well, Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us here on First Voices Radio. Such an honor to have you here. And really humbled by a lot of things, and one of them when I read Hospicing Modernity. But first, let me introduce you and thank you for being here. It's such an honor.
The honor is mine, Tickleton. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. So when you talk about defacing humanity's wrongs, and I know we did a panel a few weeks ago together, and basically I said it's like eulogy for modernity. And it's not gloom and doom as I rephrased it. And I'm thinking, how do I interview Vanessa when is that I'm trying to express feeling from my language, indigenous language, into something that it seems so hard to understand. It doesn't really relate to Earth, but yet it's looking for a connection. I want to ask that question first and foremost.
I would like to sit with that question for a week before answering that, to do justice to it. I think I will start by saying that the book came the interface between like where I was born. So I was, I come from a mixed heritage family of both indigenous and German ancestry. And one of the things that I think is interesting about that is that my dad, who is from the German ancestry side, he decided to marry an indigenous person because his brothers were involved in agrarian expansion in Brazil and were bringing in stories about indigenous genocide that was necessary for that expansion to happen. So it was sanctioned violence, state-sanctioned violence. And my dad wanted to do something about it. He wanted to make a stand. And the stand that he made was to marry an indigenous person. But the making a stand is a progressive thing, he also believed in the superiority of the German culture. So it was a paradox of being both progressive and racist at the same time. So I was born out of this paradox. My mom also agreed with him, whereas my grandmother was the one who refused to agree with the enfranchisement. She said that this was like a ticket to the Titanic, that the house that the white man built was going to collapse at some point. So she kept saying that and resisting. But one of the things that then came for me as I was born from this colonial encounter into this paradox was to look at how indigenous peoples in Brazil were analyzing the situation of the house that the white man built collapsing, right? So part of the work that informs the book is coming from the Huniqui people, who are one of the people who, the indigenous people of the Amazon forest, that see themselves as the guardians of the forest. And their understanding of colonialism is not just about the occupation of lands or the subjugation of peoples. They believe that colonialism is about the separation between us and the land, us and the cosmos, us and each other, us and the other species. So what they say is that this is not a moral problem. It is a neurophysical, neurobiological problem. That sense of separation, it imposes an impairment in our capacity to deal with reality. And the reality is a reality where we are part of a much wider metabolism, that we are the land, our bodies are land. And if we don't feel it, it leads to irresponsibility. And that irresponsibility is the hallmark of the system that we have today. It's irresponsibility and negligence. So the modernity that we talk about in the book is a way to put everything together. This separation, global capitalism, nations, modern nation states, and the cognitive imperialism that has been promoted by, we call it the House of Modernity. So the House has a foundation that is the separation, two carrying walls. One carrying wall is the modern nation state that protects capital, and it only protects people when there is interest convergence between the protection of people and the protection of capital. The other carrying wall is the carrying wall of the single story of progress, development, and civilization that has been imposed, that kills the other stories of the future, of forward. It kills our responsibility to the incoming generations of both human and non-human beings. And then the roof of the house is the roof of shareholder financial algorithmic capitalism, the current one, and that roof is leaking. It's damaged. It's structurally damaged, and it's creating a problem within the house, and it's creating a lot of mold, a lot of cracks, and the house is falling apart with all the crisis that we see. But also because the house has exceeded its the limits of the planet. So modernity now. So before, modernity had all these promises of prosperity, of progress through technology, of us conquering and dominating nature. But nature is speaking back and saying, "You are nature too, and this is not gonna pass, right?" And so the house is shaking, and we need to figure out a way to relate to that and to sober up, to grow up, to develop discernment and responsibility. Those inside the house need to do these things in order to be able to see what they need to do next. So the book offers this word, hospicing, which is about giving palliative care to something that is dying without investing in its future. We already know that the future is not going to be there. And we do that at the same time that we offer prenatal care to what is gestating, what the earth is gestating. And we do that with care, not to suffocate the baby with our own projections and idealizations of what we want to see, but we allow the baby to show us who the baby is, right? So it's very, very common in Western culture for parents to overbear the child with their own desires. But in indigenous cultures, we have the principle of non-interference. It's between the baby and the creator, what the gifts and the medicines this baby is going to give to the world are, not for us to decide.
Thank you for that, Vanessa. It would seem that reading the book, there was a certain story of medicine that you were telling in a metaphorical way, but also there came out this wisdom we need to choose correctly this time. And one of them, I think you alluded to, was no agenda, that the earth has everything in hand, so to speak. And if we only would relate our languages, our cultures, even our technologies to the sense of common well-being that she is promoting all the time, instantly and forever. She's been doing this on a continuum. And I really want to know, where would we be going if we are always looking, how would I say this now? We are talking like we're speaking from the grave. Mm-hmm. And part of that is we are looking at anti-humanist thinkers and transhumanist. And its entirety is dualistic because it's coming from a certain way of thinking, but there's never that if factor, the mystery, that wakan, we call it. Mm-hmm. And we base that so-called all humans are this way. But mm-hmm. in my lifetime, in my experience, all humans are not one way. Part of this in-stage, in-collapse is an event that people are trying to avoid. So we have this avoidance language, as you see, mm-hmm. kind of like knowing that there's not going to be any more drugs, so you're going to hoard what you can. What would the symptoms come to be so that we can identify in place our personal story with all the dwindling resources that are out there, even information?
Mm-hmm. In Brazil, we have this saying that in a situation of a flood, when the waters are rising, it's only when the waters are at our hip that we can actually swim. Before that, we can only walk and wade. So people are facing these different symptoms of the waters rising for them and relating very sometimes, because they are unequipped to relate it to it in a different way, they are relating to it with fear, which is a natural response, but it's also a response that comes from modernity itself. So modernity was also created to defeat death and to keep us in the peak of youth for the longest, right? So it's a culture that really elevates youth and doesn't see the gifts of eldership. When we were doing a project with Kesha Haneke, asking elders insight on sacred sites, what the role of education was. We never heard that the role of education was to support young people to make money. We heard that the role of education was to prepare good elders and ancestors for all relations, which is something that is often unimaginable within modern education. So there's no call for eldership, for the responsibility of eldership. So the other thing that we observed working with the Hunikui people in the Amazon was that when Western people came, non-indigenous people came for the medicines they have in the Amazon, and they have a whole kind of global pharmacy there that could be helping us with all kinds of illnesses that do not have a cure in Western medicine, but they do have some medicines that non-indigenous people can have access to. So when this non-indigenous people come to have the encounter with the sacred plants, they often come wanting this oceanic feeling that they had in the womb. Right? So they go back there maybe for self-actualization, but also to find that peace of the baby. Whereas when we look at the education that is given to the community for about these plants and for engagement with these plants, it's completely the opposite thing. It's about eldership. It's about preparing you to embrace more responsibility as you move through the stages of life and to become a good elder, to face death in a very different way. Because you know that there's no, death is not an ending. It's just a transition. And it's very difficult to reorient people who have never had those teachings towards eldership. They really want to go back to being protected with less responsibility, but eldership is about more responsibility. So changing our relationship with death and with pain as well. In Western society, being well means being without any pain, whereas in indigenous culture, especially in ceremony, we learn that we need the discipline to encounter pain in a very different way, to hold the hand of pain, to be taught by pain in a different, and not to be haunted by pain, because the fear of pain is worse than the pain many times. So how do we create the internal structure, the muscles that we need to be able to face life and death in this other way, in a way that is about embracing responsibility rather than running away from it, in a way that is about this, it is a form of care that is not self-infantilizing and that doesn't infantilize other people, where we know that educationally our main commitment is to prepare this person to accept life in all its beauty, in death, in all its beauty, as it encounters these different challenges and teachings as they go through their life. And this is not what our formal education does to people. Like we generally, with modern education, we, instead of opening up the imagination, we're limiting the imagination to the continuity of the current system. And I think that's why people are so afraid, because they can't imagine something different, a different form of well-being, for example, that is not through consumption, or a different form of well-being that is not through transactional relations. And figuring out this other way, this different neurochemical, neurophysical setup for your body, not just for your mind. Actually, in Brazil, they say it's the gut that feels it. Then the heart is filled with the motivation, and the head follows. It's not through the head, because the head already separates the head from the body. So we need to figure out how to rewire everything again.
Oh, this is so good, that the distinction between rights and responsibilities. And as you know, Ecuador a few years ago gave rights to nature, and so did New Zealand. But now that's so trendy to give rights to nature, but still, that's still in the sense of domination. Mm-hmm. And a lot of indigenous peoples, as you know, do not have the concept or the word for domination. And so how could humans give rights to nature when it's really the other way around, living living up to those responsibilities? So when I'm thinking about how is it meted out, so to speak, I'm going to go with religion and science and those dominations of it, because they, and as you described, the process of education in the West is, it takes 12 years basically in the West, in Western education, to come to know how to be reflexive to authority, because that's the program of it. And then we have to get past the barriers of speaking another codified language of academia. Part of that is, and I come with these philosophies, I call them, is that we can't educate the wisdom out of ourselves, because that's at the core of why education is there. So when I think about religion and science, the dualism we are always confronted with every day, when it's much more than just this or that.
Absolutely. And I think back to modernity again, in order to be able to defeat death, it had to have some certainties. It had to index the world in language in order to be able to control it and have knowledge that is only cumulative in a certain way and authoritative and all of that. So they created the square and went very deep into that square. The problem is that the square is not working anymore to keep us alive in the future, right? So the whole thing is falling apart because of the limits of the planet, because we have been within that square, we have neglected and been irresponsible in terms of our entanglement with everything, being part of everything. We thought that we could remove ourselves and not have to think about and just dominate and conquer. Now, both religion and science, if they are about certainty, they go in that direction. But there's also religion and science that open up a little bit to the mystery and to the unknown and the unknowable of everything. So working in academia, I had to make a decision to stay in academia out of an indigenous teaching as well. And the indigenous teaching was that, and this came from the Tremembé in the northeast of Brazil, that of all the species that exist, of all the beings, the human beings are the youngest. And of all the cultures, the Western culture is the youngest. And that really helped me then look at that as with more compassion, actually. And then that the Western culture needed to find its own maturity. And in many ways, the wisdom is also there it's hidden and buried, and people want still only the superficial things. But if you go into really, if you have the discipline to stay with the kind of science that is about the unknown, that respects the mystery of the universe, you will see that there are gifts there. If you stay with a part of religion that also respects that mystery and that opens up to being taught by the land, and it's possible, you will see that there's a gift in there. So I'm holding on to these fractures within Western science and within Western academia. It's a crack, right? There's a crack there to help them see that even by themselves they can come to maturity without losing track of the harm that they are doing to and the damage. And I don't know if we actually have the time for them to grow up, because the damage is actually escalating, right? And then that damage is affecting everybody else. So what I heard from indigenous communities is that there is a sense in which we need to parent this toddler with a machine gun in their hand and allow this culture to come to its maturity rather than replace it with other things. But it's like the uncles, aunties, and grandparents need to be around in order to be able to orient and guide the pathway away from the harm that it is doing and more harm that it can do.
This is First Voices Radio. This is Teocasin Ghost Horse, and I am speaking with Vanessa Machado de Oliveira Andriotti, and we want to welcome you back in a minute or so after these.
I've been riding waves, child, guilt through all my days, child. How this place was settled, the murder and the shame. Secrets being exposed, child. Truth we must uphold, child. Constant fight for justice to pave the way for change. Living in denial, going through the same old cycle. Penal colony survival, depending on your ball and chain. System gonna customize you. The man ain't gonna redefine you. Gotta hunt like a nighttime spider, depending on your ball and chain.
Come alive now, depending on your ball and chain.
I'm a survivor. I fall on in a deep provider. Sometimes you gotta improvise, depending on your ball and chain. System gonna customize you. The man you're gonna redefine you. Gotta hunt like a nighttime spider, depending on your ball and chain.
Welcome back to First Voices Radio. I'm Teal'c and Ghost Horse. We're talking about a book that is not easy, Hospicing Modernity. It contains no quick fix plan for a better, brighter tomorrow and gives no ready-made answers. Instead, Vanessa presents us with a challenge to grow up, step up, and show up for ourselves, our communities, and the living Earth, and to interrupt the modern behavior patterns that are killing the planet we're part of. And now part two of Hospicing Modernity and Vanessa Machado de Oliveira. I'm thinking in the context of we're arching over certain ideas and things that we have to dig up. And as you say, the youngest nation here is the Westerners, those who came on the ships. But as a view from the shore, as it is where I stand, is yes, they are younger brothers and sisters, but they still come with the plan, so to speak, right?
And the arrogance. Yes,
that's it. Exactly. So when I think about this, are you familiar with Ailton Krenak?
Ailton Krenak, yes.
Yeah. And I really like what he said about we are in a certain colonial coma. And the colonial coma that we have as indigenous peoples is to mimic the colonists. And because of loss of our cultures, it seems easier now for the youth to do this. So it's in a sense that a few years ago, they were taking down the statues of Columbus and then replacing them with indigenous statues, which is a sure sign that we are doing it in a colonial manner, like they have come to conquer. But I'm also interested in what would happen if, in this case, the friend's daughter, she asked her mother, who is always talking a great nature environmental story. So the four-year-old came up and asked her, if Mother Earth is our mother, who is Mother Earth's mother?
Mother. Aw.
Yeah. And so when I heard that, you know what I did, Vanessa, is I called my mother, and my mother said one word. She said, Nasula, we are seeds from the heart. In other words, we only come from the heart. We are seeds of the heart. And when you talk seeds of truth, that's what we're saying and feeding to the younger peoples who came on the ships. That took a long time. Sorry about that. Do you have any thoughts
beautiful.
About that?
Yeah. It's super beautiful. Yeah, we work with Bill Callum, who is an Ifa priest of this indigenous, it's an indigenous faith system in Nigeria that also speaks to other beings and doesn't make the distinction between us and nature. And they talk about the mother as a womb. So everything is a womb, and everything that comes from the womb is a seed to interact with other beings and come to its own fruition. I think that the story of the child asking that question shows that we are already past the period where modernity would be the most appealing thing for young people. Young people can see that their future is at stake, even if they come from mixed families or from indigenous families that have to encounter this dis-ease that is modernity, that is being created by Western culture being stuck in a state of self-infantilization. And they actually, because of their position in the world, they have more discernment than we do to see what wisdoms that are being offered are actually actually life affirming. And they won't go for And my hope is that they won't go for the false well-being. They will look for the true well-being, or to other options of well-being that are not just based in what you can consume. Many of our indigenous youth are numbing because the pain is very real and very deep, to see everything that is alive dying because of Western culture stuckness, right? And then having their bodies also submitted to processes of subjugation, oppression, and humiliation. So the system itself is extremely cruel towards indigenous youth. And at the same time, that experience for many is what is creating the discernment to say, I can see why this is happening, and I will choose the maturity of indigenous cultures as the basis of how I want to proceed with my life, because there's nothing, it's empty with the other offer, right? They see that. So when we look at we talked about before, the waters rising. So for some people, waters rising means not having access to jobs or to housing or to food or to water. And these are very real signs of social and ecological collapse. But for many people, especially in the Western culture and in different ways in indigenous culture, this waters rising is a way, it's rising in the heart. So we see across the board now, it's not just in indigenous communities, the rise in anxiety, depression, and self-harm. And that is also the waters rising inside, and your body saying, this cannot continue. This is not good. It's killing me from the inside. So I don't need to lose everything outside. If I'm inside, I'm also feeling the collapse, right? And I think that then that's where we see how the ceremonies can offer you the structure for the waters not to rise within you, for you to have the structure to face what you need to face, all the storms, to weather the storms, either individually or with your community. I think that is something that Western culture has lost too. And if we have seeds to offer, they will come from the ceremonies. But not necessarily, I'm not advocating Western people going to indigenous ceremonies either. I think that is a mistake. But at the same time, if we don't have the ceremonies ourselves, what we offer in terms of redirection can also be problematic, right? So we need to figure out what seed we are going to offer that will take them to their ceremonies, to new ceremonies, where they will find another way to be well and to be healthy, so that they stop the harm that they're creating. They wake up to their responsibility and to all the things that have happened, and figure out a different way to coexist in the planet if we have the time.
Such a great message, Vanessa. And I'm really thinking along the lines of respect, you know, respecting Earth, respecting Indigenous, respect for all life. And when I think about how a certain culture or civilization kind of put Native people up on pedestals, and or the opposite, but the real work is looking at us as we are a fellow human being, a human being just the same, with the same flaws, except that we, in a sense, have a relationship more with Earth rather than a connection, you see. And I think that the semantics are really understandable, and I'm glad you mentioned ceremony. Cosmologically speaking, a lot of Native people who for hundreds of thousands of years were observing the stars without telescopes, and understanding the movements, because what was happening there is still here. So when I go into the languages, which is deep, deep, and someday you'll find it, but if you haven't already, Vanessa, is that the quantum physics, so to speak, is within our languages. And we talked about the future, we talked about the past, but when it comes down to being here at this moment, there is a language that doesn't have to say to be something else or to be anything else, but who we are. And I think that's the sense of responsibility that you're talking about, because this message is beyond the book. The book is opening up the door beyond the book of hospicing modernity or any book, but it's really sitting down and communicating with each other around the fire with the water and holding those intelligences with great grace as they hold us and caring for us every minute, every second. So when I read the book, it reminded me that there's this depth within everything and how far we are away from understanding that depth, not just with mere trendy words. Like if I say, let's acknowledge the people here, it's much deeper than that. It would put me on I'm a token because you acknowledge that I was still here. That's great, but that doesn't bring up what's going on in the past, in the future, to be here right now. So the word that I'm trying to say is akantu in our language merely means earth being from the ancient future now, that we've always had these languages, that when we presented the land, such as the Mi'kmaq in Northeast Nova Scotia and then those places, they said that you, when the Vikings and other people appeared, they said, you're welcome here, but you're not welcome to own the land. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about modernity, that was the beginning of modernity. That was hospicing modernity. We were watching something from another place come here to die. And maybe that's what it is, because we include them. We can't do anything else, but our language is one of inclusion and relationship. So that's kind of like, you know, going all over the place, but that's where I come from, is all over the place, right?
I love
learning,
it.
learning to think non-dualistic, I think it's really a big feeling of energy everywhere. So part of this is really understanding how you walk your life. How does Vanessa walk her life? You say of mixed heritage, but yet inclusive in a sense, and not blaming one or the other, just like, hey, we're all in this, but there is another way to describe it, to feel it, to look at it. And maybe it's the 200,000-year-old reference of Native peoples rather than the 5,000-year-old modern thinking. What are your thoughts?
I think I'll start with what you said in the beginning, like talking about Indigenous people as subhuman is a violence, but talking about Indigenous people as superhuman is also a violence, because it puts a burden on Indigenous people to live up to other people's expectations, right? So it also puts you in a square. But I do remember also what Chief Ninala Hunikui from the Hunikui people say about technology. He says that Western people have developed very advanced technologies, that of domination, of extraction, of exploitation, and of building things. And some of these things are useful, like what he's thinking about for the Amazon, for example, is electric boats rather than diesel boats. So he's saying that we're not rejecting everything, we're rejecting the foundations of it, which sees land as property rather than as an entity, which sees the forest as money rather than beings that are everything for Indigenous people there. They say we are the forest speaking for itself. We're part, we're one with the trees, right? That's why they're putting their lives on the line to defend them. So he says that Indigenous people have advanced technologies of four things: of reverence, respect, reciprocity, and responsibility. And this is different from the advanced technologies of Western culture. And within modernity, and because we are all affected by it, because of it's so pervasive, the disease that it creates and the impairments that it creates, it's very difficult today for people who have been socialized in that not to want only the shallows, right? So they want shallow relationships, shallow experiences that are very easily consumable, that are very convenient, that do not require discipline, that do not require anything from you, that are about mastery of things rather than depth. So the depth that I hear you talking about, for me, hits my guts. And when we talk about responsibility in our project, we talk about visceral responsibility. Otherwise, in the shallows, responsibility is only an intellectual choice or a matter of convenience. But the visceral responsibility is the kind of responsibility that you put your life on the line to do what is right, to protect what is important. That's the kind of responsibility that you see the guardians of the forest enacting when they actually put their lives on the line to protect a forest that is important to all of us. That's what we see with water protectors and land protectors here as well in North America, right, in Turtle Island. That what is happening is that they cannot not do it. Like, the responsibility they feel is something that is not dependent on their self-interest. It's coming from a very different space. But that space, you need to open up, because we are so addicted to the pleasures and the promises of the shallows that depth sometimes is even unimaginable. How do you feel that is something that requires a different relationship with the land already, right? And that requires you to surrender the arrogance and the individualism that you carry with you and put it back on the land, so that the land can speak through you and the land can dream through you. And in order to do that, you have both to have the structure and the strength for that to happen, but you need to decenter your ego, because if your ego is speaking, the land doesn't have a chance. Your ego has a megaphone, right?
Well, it's great to have you here. You said something about the protectors, protection, and Akichita it doesn't mean warrior or go to war. It means to protect what is, because that's the bigger message. And when you talked about the natives in the jungle and the Amazon, they're not getting paid to, yet environmentalists get paid because they go and study the earth. Well, and the other way is that what I think is, when I go home, the earth is studying me. The earth acknowledges me, and that I feel cared for by the earth. And this is why my responsibility in that sense is clean air, clean water, clean food. And from that come clean thoughts, clean beings, and generations of that. But it's not sort of much. An accomplishment to look at and show, look, I did this and I did that, sort of turning in life in the world into a meritocracy. It's like, no, this is a continuance of who we are, is to bring that legacy of those ancestors into the future as well. And I think that you're doing that very well with this book, and I want to just understand it in a good way, that the ceremonies that you have undergone and have helped you in your confluence of interpretation, but that respect for these ceremonies, they're always moving. It's not like a ritual in one place. We could say the procedure may be, but still it is, well, yeah, the ceremony possession. It's different when we hold something in Arizona, like a Sundance, or it's different in Dakotas or Canada or Brazil, wherever it's held, because it's according to that land where the ceremony is in motion. So a ceremony is about keeping in motion. And the old adage that life is a ceremony is so true, to be careful of what we say, how we think, and how we're relating to. So in a sense, I'll end it in this way, that Wachekia really means not prayer. It means acknowledging relationship.
Absolutely. I think what grounded my experiences in the ceremonies was learning to relate and to build relationships based on trust, consent, respect, and accountability. And this is not something we learn in the modern education system, in the formal education system. So my education, and I'm just beginning that education there, was about understanding that for the book, a ceremony needed to be done to ask for permission for the book to come through. And every day as I was writing the stories, I was trying to ask what stories will need to come to move what you need to move, not what I need to move. It's what the holding of everything needs to move. And when once the book was finished, there was also a ceremony to release it to the world and not to be to make it mine, or as you said before, that it becomes an accumulation of achievements that then becomes part of a meritocracy. The book, I wrote the book also with I was instructed to use my the name before my marriage, my original first name, also to create a distance from the book and my other trajectory, especially the academic trajectory, so that I could offer the book in a good way. And the book then becomes its own entity. The stories are dancing in there, and they will do their work, and I need to respect that and have reverence for that too, but not because, as I said before, I think I say that in the book, some of the stories that came, I resisted. I said, I don't want the story to be out there, but I needed to negotiate internally, spiritually too, if the story needed to go. It's not up to my ego to decide what's going to happen here, right? So it's a very interesting training of decentering ourselves so that other things can work through, and having the ceremonies, not only the ceremonies that I participate too, like there are ceremonies happening in the South in Brazil that have all this work protected as well, right? So respecting that indigenous people are doing their work, and the work that they probably are the only ones who can do it to support the Western culture to figure out what they need to figure out, to wake up, to step up, to grow up, and to show up differently for the planet and for the others, and join this big circle that you talked about of people who need to be protectors of not only everything that we're part of, but the future of the incoming generations.
Thank you for these good energy thoughts. And I want to cheat and say one more question, Vanessa, one more question. Is that the younger brothers and sisters come and they usually have a plan, and that plan is more or less to adapt the earth to their needs. Now they need to let go of that, so to speak, and really look at how we need to adapt ourselves to the earth. I think that that's an over the difference between Western and, you know, who is a real Westerner, but those of us in a Western hemisphere before the West arrived, so to speak.
Yeah, the shedding, right? The invitation for them to surrender the arrogance, the plans, the agenda, and to be naked to the earth and reestablish that relationship is one of the things. It's a challenge, but it's necessary before they can embrace the journey. But they're getting there. Maybe it is the storms themselves that are going to force them to take their to become, to have their spirit naked, to go back to that relationship.
Wow. So good to have you here on First Voices Radio, Vanessa. And how do I convey the humbleness of someone who is experienced with indigeneity, and that the indigeneity comes through as it comes through us eating every day the plants, the plant nation, that indigeneity is what I'm talking about. So again, I'd like to say, Doksha Ake Wachinkyanke Kite, which means something like, I'll see you again eventually, but surely, right? And I want to say, Anawakopta Nankapikihe, Bilamaya Yapi, thank you all for listening out there. Vanessa, any final words after we've listened to you carefully? Daya Anagopta Yo, we've listened to you carefully.
I just wanted to say it was the greatest honor to be invited here. I've been doing a lot of podcasts about the book, but this is the greatest honor that I had, to be invited by you to be here, and with reverence to all the knowledge, all the experiences you've had. It just filled my heart with happiness to be able to be in conversation with you today. Thank you.
So awesome. Have a great day. Okay. Have
Thank
a good
you.
Rest of the day. Make it your day. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Wow. That was amazing. At least for me as an individual, as a person of the Lakota people, of the Lakota Nation, of the indigenous nations of Turtle Island, in Turtle Island, within Turtle Island. Those of you who came here later may or may not understand that, but somewhere it should spark the indigeneity in you to respect those indigenous peoples who have been here and are here and will be here long after this modernity has taken its place with grace and moved on its way. Maybe to another planet, maybe just have to bury it. And that starts with the mental capability that it is incapable of really understanding Earth as well, at least in this place, at least in this part of the world, the Western Hemisphere, as long as we have as indigenous folks. But we will not lose it. We always remember it because it's the land who remembers us. You think about that, and maybe there's something else that will open up within you to understand what we're saying here as indigenous peoples. Wakamazi waglake ihanta tayana kopteye toksha ake wachian kinkte. Thank you for listening. This is First Voices Radio. See you next time.
In the Anthropocene, what does your freedom mean? What does your freedom mean? In the Anthropocene, all along the water, underneath the sea, can you hear the thousand mile melody? Coming from a distant whale, calling from afar, calling through the ocean channel, saying, saying, can you hear me?
Soil come back and the listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Howdy, everybody. This is Wade Hockett. I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, the station that Robbie Folks and Rose Maddox listen to when they are in the area. Stand by for the noontime jamboree.
Hey, what?